Welcome to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett, and we begin our Friday roundup today with Metro News, the excessive heat edition of Metro News. Joining us are WFPL News Director Gabe Bullard, political editor Philip Bailey, and our newest addition to the newsroom, Devin Katayama. Devin, let me formally welcome you, and welcome to the program as well, and
thanks
welcome
so
all of you.
Thank you.
Erica Peterson will be joining us later, and we want you to join us now. Last week, we began opening up the phone lines for your comments on the stories we're discussing, and we're going to do it again today. 814-TALK, 814-8255, or toll-free, 1-800-814-8255. You can also email us at news@wfpl.org, and of course, we're also on Twitter, WFPL News, and on Facebook. Gabe Bullard, let's begin with you. A lot of reporting here and elsewhere this week on this big planned hospital merger involving a U of L hospital, Jewish Hospital St. Mary's, and Catholic Health Initiatives based in Denver. A lot of questions raised about how Catholic doctrine is going to affect the operation of the new entity.
Yeah, when this was first announced last year, it was unclear whether University of Louisville Hospital would adopt the ethical Catholic directives, which do not allow for certain reproductive health issues. It's a little different with end-of-life care, no abortions, obviously, but also with contraception, vasectomies, things like that. There's this gap between what the Catholic Church allows and what the law allows. And it was unclear, like I said, if U of L Hospital would adopt that. When Jewish Hospital merged with St. Mary's Healthcare, they did not change those policies within Jewish Hospital. But as these negotiations went on, it became clear that U of L Hospital and Jewish Hospital would have to start adopting some of these directives. The big question, most of these things have been worked out according to U of L officials. The big question is tubal ligations or tube tying after cesarean sections. A lot of women get that while they are still open for the cesarean section to avoid what could be another dangerous pregnancy or another surgery. And that's not allowed by the Catholic Church. The tube tying isn't allowed, and it has to be done in a hospital. Before, U of L officials had said, well, the medical school isn't part of this merger. A lot of these services, vasectomies, things like that, can be done as an outpatient service at another U of L facility, or they already are done as an outpatient service at another U of L facility. For something like this that can't be done in a hospital, that's the sticking point in these negotiations. Dean Edward Halperin of the medical school has said they had 10 issues, including abortion, vasectomies, all that, that they needed to work out a reasonable way to provide, and they have. Tubal ligations after cesarean section, they have not worked out. And so a lot of the coverage is centered around these questions of how that could possibly be solved. The U of L officials say there are a number of solutions, but they won't share what any of those are.
They had a press conference this week to that effect to say, we'll take care of it. We'll give you the details later.
Yes, they did that on Wednesday. They said there's extensive literature that cites examples, but if you want to know what those examples are, go find the literature yourself, essentially. And they ran an ad stating something similar today. It's a full page on the back of the Metro section of the Courier-Journal, this ad from officials with U of L and from Jewish Hospital saying, the doctors in the merged hospital will follow Catholic directives, but the medical school is not part of the merger. And this faculty, while they will be the same, will follow one set of directives inside the hospital, another one outside.
Attorney General Jack Conway also wants to take a look at this agreement, right?
Yeah, he's looking into it. He says he's heard even from doctors within the system who are unclear on what's happening. He told me yesterday that he thinks this whole thing may have been a little rushed in the announcement of it. When it was announced last year, it wasn't necessarily a big secret that these talks had been going on, but they did announce it before a lot of these details have been worked out. So a lot of the coverage, and even Conway says there are no conclusions that he's come to. He doesn't want to say this merger is bad, this merger is going to cut off these services, but no one can say that it won't either at this point, that there are all these questions, these things that haven't been worked out, these things that maybe the partners before heading into it hadn't fully thought about.
Now, Mayor Fisher has also gotten involved as well. He's had a talk with U of L President Ramsey about it.
Yeah, he's met with some of the officials there. He met with President Ramsey, and he's involved in this. Three members of the Metro Council also, Marianne Butler, Tina Ward-Pugh, and Vicki Aubrey-Welch, along with four state lawmakers, have signed this petition that's going to be published as an ad this weekend in the Courier-Journal both days, calling for the merger to stop.
Oh, really? Now, there's public money coming from the council and the state for indigent care at U of L Hospital.
Yes, there is. And, Philip, you talked with, was it Councilwoman Welch about that?
Yeah, Councilwoman Welch, in her conversation, in my conversation with her, she indicated that the $7 million that Metro government gives for indigent care to University Hospital could be under review. And she asked her her concern. She says that the main concern that she has and the reason she signed the petition was that you have poor patients who use University Hospital as a safety net that's funded by taxpayer dollars, and that if necessary, that funding would be shifted to other hospitals or pulled from University Hospital and given to others. So certainly, I think city officials are paying much more attention to this, as it's having a real life, or potentially could have a real life impact on constituents.
Gabe, have there been similar agreements elsewhere in the country where they've worked these things out?
There have been a lot of mergers like this. In fact, the most repeated statistic I could find is that about 1 in 6 patients now in America go to a hospital with some religious affiliation. And so there have been a lot of these mergers because Catholic hospitals especially tend to not have a lot of the financial issues that secular hospitals or hospitals affiliated with other religions tend to for whatever reason. And in Austin is the case that is often brought up, and that's the case. There's this group Merger Watch that generally goes and they oppose hospital mergers like this to protect access to care for women and indigents. They cite this example in Austin where a hospital within a hospital was created. When a city-owned hospital was merging with a Catholic institution, they set aside the fifth floor as essentially a secular zone, and that's a women's clinic that handles all births, all maternity issues. It handles things like emergency contraception for rape victims, vasectomies for men are handled there, contraception counseling. It all happens on that fifth floor of this Austin hospital, while the floors above and below, it could be a five-floor hospital, but all the other floors in the building just follow the Catholic directives. So that's something that that Merger Watch is citing. There will be $15 million set aside in this merger here locally to upgrade or build new facilities to provide a lot of these services. It's not clear what form that will take, if maybe one floor of University Hospital will be set aside, if maybe another building will be renovated to provide that. So if someone is having a baby, they know to go there instead of to University Hospital. They will need operating rooms. They'll need offices and a lot of other facilities that may exist already but would just have to be either renovated or officially set aside. The problem with that is mergers, as Attorney General Jack Conway pointed out, create an economy of scale. You cut down on a lot of the extra red tape. Creating a floor that's separate from the rest of the hospital like that involves quite a bit of red tape. There's a separate insurance plan. There's separate staffing things that have to be done. There's separate licenses to obtain from the state. There's a lot of work to do to get that approval for that floor. And then you also, there's financial issues as well, and having to pay one group of people and another group of people and all that. So that's something that could be looked into. It's something that very well may happen, but it's something that even more questions surround.
And finally, assuming that these issues are worked out, when will this agreement be finalized?
It's not clear yet that I've heard.
So it could be, is there a timetable within a year or within?
There was talk that it could happen. I believe when it was first announced, there was talk it could happen this year. It's looking like it's going to happen a little later. And one thing to note, as Attorney General Jack Conway is looking into this, he can't stop this. If he decides he doesn't like what he sees, he and no one else at the state could actually stop this merger from happening. The Federal Trade Commission could stop it, and Conway says that if he doesn't like what he finds out, if he doesn't like the answers he gets, that he'll consult with some of the federal regulators he knows to tell them that, you know, to essentially act on it.
All right, we'll keep an eye on it, and thank you, Gabe. Moving on now to Philip M. Bailey. And the Kentucky governor's race, Governor Steve Beshear, Senate President David Williams finally got into the same room as candidates this week at the Kentucky Farm Bureau headquarters here in Louisville, the Farm Bureau Forum. They have a Measure the Candidates forum. The format, Philip, doesn't really allow for back and forth questioning or rebuttal between the candidates, but that didn't stop them from going after each other.
Yeah, the organizers stressed this wasn't a debate, but the fact that the two men maybe didn't address each other directly didn't stop them from trading barbs. As you mentioned, Senate President David Williams, the Republican, he set up more as the aggressor, I think, in this conversation. Being that he's 20 points down in the polls, he has to prove to voters that not only is Steve Beshear not doing a good job, but that you should hire me to do it instead. So a lot of his points were that Beshear hasn't led on a number of these key issues, whether agricultural policy, tax reform, education, and federal regulations. So what you saw was that Mr. Williams brought up the point that, you know, on the issue of tax reform, for example, states are more competitive, in his view, than Kentucky because they have a better tax system. Mr. Williams said that our tax system here in Kentucky is broken. And he cited Tennessee as an example because they don't have an income tax in the state. And that's one of the reasons that they're able to leap ahead. Governor Beshear responded by not by addressing Mr. Williams directly, but by saying essentially that the Senate president has a love affair with Tennessee.
And we're 19th in the country in terms of best business tax climate. 19th. Guess where Tennessee is? 27th. I don't know the love that this fellow over here has for the Big Orange. I'll tell you, I don't like their football. I don't like their basketball. And that Jack Daniels is not bourbon.
And with that, I think the governor probably got the zing of the day. Yeah. That's certainly something that Senator Williams did not appreciate. He said that, you know, the state's economic situation is no laughing matter. It's not a joke. In fact, the Williams campaign sent out a press release a few days later pointing out that Jack Daniels is a Louisville-based company, and saying that Governor Beshear hates Jack Daniels and is against one of Louisville's better companies. So the trade between these two, I mean, let's go back to the fact that since Governor Beshear has taken office, the one man who has probably stood in the way of his agenda, particularly on expanding gaming, has been Senator Williams. He's been able to successfully block the governor's agenda throughout. But as we saw in that exchange, and later on, Senator Williams saying that's not a joke, you shouldn't really make light of the situation, more and more Williams is having to fight the own perception that he has, the people have of him, as a bully, as someone who is not, maybe have the temperament to be the governor. Williams addressed that during the forum, essentially saying that while I may not necessarily be the most well-liked person in Frankfort, I'm probably the best equipped person to take Governor Beshear's position.
Now, you might think that I'm a little tough on these situations. And some people might say, David, that makes you not very likable. I'm not running for cruise director on the good ship Lollipop. We need tough leadership in this state, not someone who just runs tough ads.
And there you have it. And I think that for Senator Williams, you see in his first ad, which he released this week, he talked about his father. He talked about, you know, why he wants to run for governor, trying to soften his image. But at the same time, I think that Mr. Williams is positioning himself by saying the thing that many people consider to be my negative is actually a positive. It's something where I'm seen as someone who gets things done, and that unlike the incumbent, I will strive and sort of push issues that you don't see really pushed at the state level thus far.
We thought about digging up that song for the program, but thought better of it.
The Shirley Temple song.
The Shirley Temple song.
I've pushed actually for it to be a trending topic on Twitter.
Okay.
And the Williams campaign seems to agree.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, we'll see what happens. Now, there will be a third candidate on the ballot, apparently. Gatewood Galbraith has filed his paper. He's got the signatures needed to get on the as an independent.
Yes, for the fifth time, Lexington attorney Gatewood Galbraith is going to run for governor, an independent who has been zigzagging across the state really thus far. You need 5,000 signatures as an independent to be on the November ballot. He exceeded that. He got about 7,500 signatures. He did just make a slight mishap. He didn't bring his campaign treasurer with him when he turned in the paperwork, but I believe that campaign treasurer did show up later that day to sign the proper documents in order for him to be on the ballot. It's not clear who Mr. Galbraith will hurt or help as an independent candidate, but he certainly has been someone who has delivered better than expectations for independent candidates in the past. So he's could be considered a spoiler depending on how he, what voters show up for him during this general election.
You're listening to State of the News on WFPL. We'd like to hear from you as well at 814-TALK, 814-8255. You have some comments on what we're discussing news-wise today. Also, 1-800-814-8255 is a toll-free number. You can reach us at news@WFPL.org on the email. We're also on Twitter, WFPL News, and we're on Facebook as well. Back to you, Philip, on the Judy Green case, Metro Councilwoman Judy Green facing a removal trial. I guess it's going to be called now. What's the latest on that?
Well, when it comes to this ongoing situation with Councilwoman Green, the trial date has finally been set. It will be on September 12th. The Metro Council Court, which is the remaining members who did not charge her with the misconduct allegations, they will make up the jury. They were sworn in Monday. They have decided that September is the best date to go forward. There had been some slight disagreement. It made herding cats seem a little easier, in fact, because they had to schedule a time period that was within the 60 days of when the initial charges were filed by the charging committee. But at the same time, they didn't want to wait too much longer and had to negotiate some of those dates with Councilman Green's attorney, Derwin Webb, who felt that the council was trying to rush the proceedings. Initially, council members wanted to have the trial as early as August 5th. Mr. Webb said that that was absolutely too soon. He just took on the case and that he had some other scheduling conflicts for other dates that the council had debated. So Councilman Kelly Down at the chair pushed for the council to have a solid date coming out. But during the week, you saw an exchange between Green's attorney and council members about those dates and about why it was so difficult. One of the exchanges in particular was between Mr. Webb and Councilman Brent Ackerson.
All right, Brad, let's listen to that tape now.
I'm not in favor of delaying this process for too long. I feel like the hour is ripe. The evidence is there, and it's just a question of getting it on the record, and from there we can decide one way or the other. And so I'm urging this body to recognize that drawing this matter out much longer is probably not a good thing for the community, nor this body, nor this process. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
With all due respect, and I understand your statement about the amount of time that's taken to this point, but with all due respect, if this was the only client that I did have, I would have no problems with that. But considering I did get the case last week, and there are a lot of things to get my arms around, as well as some other things that we will have to do prior to that, I do believe that a little ample time would be in favor of my client to at least allow her to have the best, fair, and equitable hearing possible. Now, once again, I'm saying that this is the first time I've ever been in front of this committee, and I'm hoping that we will have an opportunity to defend her in the best light possible, and we surely will. But I'm just saying that a very short turnaround, as you're suggesting, without me having any preparation at this point, yes, there are some things on the record that I can go back and look at, but Dr. Green is not my only client, so I'm asking for some time to be able to represent her as fairly and equitably as possible, as this court would like to have all matters being heard.
Mr. Downer, may I
respond
to that?
Sure.
Well, Mr. Webb, as we know, if we were over at Circuit Court, the judge would pose the question to you or I at this point, well, how much time do you need, sir?
Well, why don't we say September? We can look at sometime in September if that's the case, considering I do have some trials that have already been scheduled for the month of August. So if I were to be looking at my calendar, I would look at sometime close to the end of September if I'm being put on the spot like this. So if we could say sometime at the end of September, that would be great for not only me, but I'm pretty sure my client as well, so we can adequately prepare for what needs to take place.
We are going to have to talk off camera because my initial reaction is that's a pretty long time.
All right. So, and we settled on when? September?
September 12th. And you see there, I think that for everyone, there's a bit of Green fatigue, whether her supporters or her critics. This process has really been going on since January. I think you've heard council members say, let's get done with this one way or the other. Let's get past this. As Councilman James Peden said at yesterday's meeting, for some people, this is becoming not only long and drawn out, but a little bit embarrassing for Metro government as a whole.
All right. Thank you very much, Philip M. Bailey. And we're going to turn now to Devin Katayama here on State of the News on WFPL, on our Metro News segment. Passport back in the news, Devin, the Attorney General getting involved in the repayment of some dividends.
That's right. This actually began with an audit back in November of 2010. And what the audit found, among other things, was that Passport Healthcare was giving money back to some of its members. Those members include Norton Hospital, Jewish and St. Mary's Incorporated, University Medical Center, University Physicians Associates. And the reason that Attorney General Jack Conway said that they were doing this was so that they can get a better rate of Medicare money from the state. And the money that they gave was around $30 million back to these four entities. Jack Conway's office found that around $26.4 million of that $30 million was not being used for Medicaid purposes. And because Passport is a nonprofit corporation, that's illegal. Attorney General Jack Conway said that money must be given back, and that's what they announced this week. They also found that in the notes of the board meeting that there's very little questioning from a lot of the board members. That's also partly due because the board is made up of all affiliates of Passport. And what Jack Conway recommended was that some of the board become independent board members, and that's what Passport's going to take up in the fall.
Now, do these providers have to pay all this money back in a lump sum?
It's going to be paid over 5 years. Some of them, like Norton, are going to be paying back immediately, which is $4 million. UPA is paying $7.2 million immediately as well. And then the rest of that over four payments, the rest of their $7.2 million over four payments again. Jewish is paying back $4 million over 3 years. And again, University Medical Center over five payments, 5 years.
Now, this week you also covered, of course, Mayor Fisher has formed this Merger 2.0 committee to look at the city-county merger down the road, and there's been some meetings regarding fire and EMS.
Yeah, this is actually a subcommittee on fire and EMS, and this is a particularly interesting topic to me. I used to be an EMT in Northern California, so I took an interest in this. This meeting, it was to show Louisville Metro EMS and how it operates to the fire department. And Kristen Miller, who kind of heads the Louisville Metro EMS, gave a presentation on some of the new technology that they're using over there. And some of it's really interesting stuff. They're using a program that nobody else in the nation right now is using. They're using it in Australia and England. What this program is it's part of MetroSafe. They, you know, work with MetroSafe. Somebody will call 911, and the 911 operator will determine whether or not this call is a high priority or not. If it's not, they'll send it on over to this program called SIAM. And what SIAM is, it's a nurse sitting with the 911 operator who determines whether or not they need EMS services. This is good for the patient. It's also good for the EMS system because the patient will not have to pay for the high price of, let's say, an ambulance ride or ER work. And they'll be diverted to sources or resources that are necessary, more necessary for them. It also saves time that the ambulance can be on another call. So this is what the fire department and EMS were discussing. The fire department seemed very skeptical about some of the technology, with good reason. Some of the technology didn't seem quite up to par with where it should be or where it wants to be, but it's definitely something that they're going to be considering. And they have until October 2nd to make a recommendation to Merger 2.0 Task Force. So we'll see what they come up with.
All right, very good. Devin Katayama, thanks for joining us today, and you'll be keeping us posted on that and other stories. And once again, welcome to the WFPL Newsroom. Before the time gets away from us, Gabe, I want to go back to you. You've been reporting this week on the situation with Borders bookstores. We're losing the final ones here in Louisville.
Yeah, there used to be four in Louisville, and two were lost in February, or was announced that they would close in February when Borders first filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. Those were the stores on 4th Street Live, and also, if memory serves me, was it Hurstbourne. So the two that remained were on Bardstown Road and Shelbyville Road Plaza. Those two now will be closing as well, as Borders cannot find a buyer for a lot of its assets and has sought permission and been granted permission to liquidate.
Also talk of the sale of Insight.
Yeah, Insight Cable has quietly put itself up for auction. Bids came in. According to the Wall Street Journal, they found sources close to the sale. Close to the auction. There haven't been a lot of people speaking publicly about this. They say Time Warner Cable and a few regional cable outlets have all put in their bids of around $3 billion for Insight. But Insight spokespeople say they're not selling, or they're not necessarily selling, that it's something that they do from time to time just to kind of take an assessment of what Insight's options are for the future. But it doesn't necessarily mean there will be a sale.
And finally, Philip, some sort of late breaking news out of Metro Animal Services. A well-known figure at MAS has submitted a resignation.
Yes, Jackie Golby, the assistant director at Louisville Metro Animal Services, she resigned on July 14th, even though this is just now coming out. She's the third high-profile resignation of that department in recent years. Obviously, people remember that former director Dr. Gilles Maloche resigned in end of 2009, and that his replacement, interim director Wayne Zielinski, resigned in February after it came out that he was running a security website that did some security services for some adult entertainers. So Ms. Golby is resigning, and what's interesting about this, amid controversy, a memorandum was leaked to the media essentially says that by an employee that says that accuses Ms. Golby and an unknown man of coming into the Manslake Road shelter with a dog, with an elderly beagle dog, in a suitcase, and that supposedly the employee says that Ms. Golby said that the dog was a stray dog that bit her. The man drops the dog in the suitcase on the concrete floor, and then Ms. Golby and the man just leave the shelter. The mayor's office says that, I guess in previous reports and other media outlets saying that there weren't have been no files or charges have been filed against Ms. Golby, but that she has leaving the department after, I think, more than 10 years working for the city.
And she was quite the public face of the Department of Well.
Yeah,
she did these little segments on various TV or radio stations.
Yeah, I mean, she did a lot of the animal sort of public service announcements. She was the spokeswoman for the department for a number of years. She, I guess, in many ways, started the focus on LMAS because she was one of the people who filed a sexual harassment lawsuit against the former director, Dr. Gilles Meloche, a few years back. So it's, once again, this department has had continued troubles. Mayor Fisher is planning on naming a new director, a new permanent director, next week. It's an ongoing situation at LMAS.
All right. Thanks to Philip M. Bailey, Gabe Buller, Devin Katayama from the WFPL newsroom in our first Metro segment. When we come back, our environment reporter, Erica Peterson, will be joining us, and we're going to listen to her a series of reports this week on coal ash here in the Louisville area. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News on WFPL. I'm Rick Howlett, and this is our Metro segment, part two, as we discuss the developments from the past week and the past few weeks here in the metro area. We welcome your comments on what's happening. You can call us at 814-8255, 814-8255, or toll-free 1-877-814-8255, 877-814-TALK. You can email us, news at WFPL.org. We're on Twitter at WFPL News, and we're also on Facebook. Well, coal generates more than half of the nation's energy, and it's burned in power plants in all but four states. One inevitable byproduct of burning coal is ash. A lot of coal ash is in Kentucky, Indiana, and throughout the Ohio River Valley. In a special report, WFPL's Erica Peterson looks at the health and environmental concerns the ash is raising for residents of a neighborhood in southwest Louisville.
You can't see the smokestacks of the Cane Run Power Station from Stephanie Hogan's home, even though she lives a block away. And while the power plant isn't visible, it's still a looming presence in Hogan's life.
You want to say hi?
I can hear him breathing.
Oh, he breathes so bad. He sounds like Darth Vader. Oh, my bubby, and you ain't even been running.
That's her 2-year-old son, Cody, breathing. He's sitting on the floor, playing with a puzzle.
My little guy. Thank
you.
Mommy loves you.
Mama.
I'm your mama. I love you, bubby.
The family bought their trailer near the Louisville Gas and Electric-operated power plant about 15 months ago. And since then, Cody has developed serious respiratory problems. Eventually, his mom took him to a specialist who pinpointed the potential cause of Cody's sickness.
I think it was the second visit she asked where we lived, and when I told her, she said, oh, you live next to that power plant. You need to move.
But Hogan can't move. She's trapped by her trailer's low resale value, as well as her son's rising medical expenses. Cody has asthma. He's had tubes installed in his ears twice, and 3 times he's come down with an unexplained fever. Hogan estimates she spent nearly $4,000 in doctor's visits and medication last year. She says the culprit is coal ash, the sometimes fine, sometimes chunky material that's left over after coal is burned. It coats her porch, and she doesn't let Cody play outside anymore, no matter how much he begs.
You gotta watch it. When you laugh too hard, sometimes you have an asthma attack. Don't laugh too hard. Don't laugh too hard.
You could fill the boxcars of a train, a freight train, that would stretch from New York City to Melbourne, Australia, every year with the coal ash that American power plants generate.
This is Jeff Stant. He's the director of the Environmental Integrity Project's Coal Combustion Waste Initiative.
People breathe it in. Their lungs never get rid of it. It has metals that cross the lung tissues into the bloodstream. There have been studies done on the exposure of rats to this kind of dust and other lab animals, and it's been the results have been very disturbing.
At the Cane Run plant, the ash is stored in a landfill and a pond. The pond is invisible from the road, but the landfill is pretty obvious. Huge piles of slate-gray coal ash rising off the banks of the Ohio River. At the base of the landfill is a pauper's cemetery.
Kind of fitting, you know? It really is, because that's where they want to be. They want to be within the poorest of the poor areas.
Kathy Little lives in one of the houses facing the power plant. The Cane-run power station is one of three area LG&E coal-fired plants. It burns 1.3 million tons of coal every year. Last year, it produced 160,000 tons of coal ash. Before the ash is placed in a landfill, it's mixed with different materials that create a cement-like consistency. It's loaded into piles, which is where LG&E's Mike Winkler says it stays.
It's plenty heavy enough to stay in place, and during the placement process, if it's too dry, then it's wetted. We'll have trucks that come through and spray it to give it wetness, but it's got enough moisture in it that it doesn't blow off in general.
But as we walk down the street, Little points to the air above the landfill.
Yeah, there it goes. See the black up there? You'll see some ash blowing.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, that's what they're trying to keep on their property. And it's not happening.
Sure enough, ash wisps are flying off. They end up on nearby porches and siding. For the neighbors, this is annoying and also worrisome. Samples taken by the Louisville Metro Air Pollution Control District and, most recently, LG&E itself, have confirmed the presence of fly ash on several area homes.
Okay, here's our ash pond.
Steve Turner, the general manager at LG&E's Cane Run Power Station, is giving Kathy Little and her husband Tony a tour. After the company released the results of their sampling, they convened the three families whose homes were sampled for a meeting. LG&E is doing damage control.
And here you can see bottom ash, but it's down at the water level, so it stays wetted.
But there are conflicting data. The first samples taken directly off their homes show alarmingly high amounts of fly ash. But the second set, gathered from the air, shows much lower levels. Turner stands in a conference room in front of a PowerPoint presentation about the company's operation.
So to get started, of course, this is the Cane Run site. We are a generating facility. We generate electricity, and we do that safely, reliably, and while complying with all of our environmental permits.
The people in the room want to talk about the ash. As Turner speaks, Debbie Walker shakes her head. She looks disgusted.
Why don't you live by it?
Well, the health issue...
We can't leave because nobody's going to buy our places because it's dumb. If you don't think it's a health issue, I ask anybody in this room to go live by it.
Well,
that's what I thought.
But the company isn't sure what to do about it. Cane Run is a coal-fired power plant, and it's impossible to burn coal without creating coal ash. The plant's pond and landfill hold hundreds of thousands of tons of coal ash, and that amount is growing. It's growing because Americans' consumption of coal is rising. From 1989 to 2009, the amount of coal burned in the U.S. increased by more than 100 million tons. New pollution control devices on power plants are exacerbating the problem. Jeff Stant of the Environmental Integrity Project says while these devices reduce air pollution, they increase the amount of waste.
The more you try to control the emissions of a power plant, the more toxic the ash becomes and the more ash you generate.
LG&E says it's considering a few different options to control the ash the plant's neighbors see flying off the landfill. They might put an adhesive on the landfill, and they're trying to reduce the amount of dust that's kicked up by trucks on roads nearby. The company says more testing is needed to determine whether fly ash is leaving the site. But if Metro government decides the dust is posing a nuisance to the plant's neighbors, LG&E may be forced to take action. The company is planning to stop putting ash in the current landfill soon and start putting it in another yet-to-be-built landfill. The new landfill is designed to hold 16 to 20 years of coal ash, but the company estimates the plant won't be burning coal for that long. If upcoming federal regulations make it too expensive to burn coal, the plant may switch to natural gas or even shut down. Regardless, LG&E's Mike Winkler says the coal ash will remain.
It will stay, and then ultimately, if this facility is closed from the standpoint of burning coal, then there are closure plans for landfills and ash ponds that you have to develop with the state, where essentially they're capped with clay, and then there's monitoring that goes on associated with that.
That doesn't make Kathy Little feel better about living across from the landfill and pond, especially since there's nothing between the ash and the ground. She worries the groundwater is contaminated.
You know, they've put all this here. Now what are we going to do with it? Are we going to have to live with this, you know, with this toxic dump is basically what it is. Even if they cover it up, it's a toxic dump.
But LG&E says it's not a toxic dump, and the federal government hasn't called it that either, yet. Kathy Little and Debbie Walker stand in Walker's front yard, 50 feet from the ash landfill at Cane Run. They watch as heavy machinery backs up, pushing ash from one pile to another. Walker says she used to be able to see Indiana from her window. Now she just sees the mountains of coal ash.
But no, that wasn't here when we first moved here. If that was here when I first moved here, I wouldn't have moved here. No. There's no way. But yeah, you can.
Little says she feels abandoned by federal and state regulators.
And I have nothing against coal. Don't get me wrong, I don't. The coal didn't cause this situation. This private company caused the situation, and Kentucky allowed them to do it. That's who I blame.
The women say they feel like there are no regulations in place. There are, but they're not always easy to notice. When a power company wants to build a landfill or storage pond, it has to get a permit from the Kentucky Department of Waste Management. For landfills, it also needs a permit from the Army Corps of Engineers. There's a water quality certificate from the state for discharge and a permit from Metro government for air emissions. The Federal Environmental Protection Agency doesn't regulate coal ash. Last year, it proposed two rules, one to regulate ash as a hazardous material and another to designate it a special waste. Environmental groups have been lobbying for the former, while the coal industry wants the latter. LG&E's John Voyle says if the EPA characterizes coal ash as a hazardous waste, it will halt coal ash recycling. Right now, there's a small industry centered around repurposing coal ash in materials like cement. Voyle says all that ash could end up in a landfill if it's suddenly declared toxic.
All the beneficial reuse things will disappear because you won't have people wanting to suddenly say, well, I want to put a hazardous product in a gypsum wallboard or in a cement. You know, where does it go? If it's declared hazardous, it's hazardous.
Ash recycling is something that the utility company likes to talk about. If the ash is reused, it doesn't take up space in landfills or ponds. Plus, the utility company can profit off the waste. Jeff Stant of the Environmental Integrity Project agrees with the utilities that recycling the ash is essential. But he says some of the so-called beneficial reuses for coal ash, like building roads or filling in wetlands, are even worse for the environment.
It has to be ash that's put in concrete or cement or shingles in a way that it's encapsulated, and the metal's leaching potential is made very low.
But in reality, coal ash recycling is still a small industry. According to the American Coal Ash Association, nationwide, about 41% of the coal ash produced in 2009 was recycled in some way. At Cane Run, that figure was much smaller for the same year. Only about 4% of their ash was recycled. The rest goes to the landfill or pond. In her trailer, a block away from the plant, Stephanie Hogan watches her 2-year-old son Cody play. Out of fear that his breathing problems were caused by the coal ash that coats her porch, Hogan won't let him outside. At this point, Hogan wants LG&E to fix the situation, no matter the cost.
They're going to have to upgrade what they have now, and they want to pass it on to us. They want to pass that on to the consumer. So it's like you're poisoning my child, and you want me to pay for you not to poison him. Pretty much is what I got out of it.
But while a lot of the neighborhood's anger is focused at the power company, many are bewildered why this is allowed to happen. Kathy Little has asked for help from Metro government and the state, but still hasn't seen results.
We all work very, very hard and pay taxes. We basically pay taxes to these government agencies that are supposed to protect our children. And we are paying a very high price for cheap electricity, for cheap power.
Erica Peterson, WFPL News.
And Erica Peterson now joins us on State of the News. Hello, Erica.
Hi, Rick.
Well, a few questions, follow-up questions. You mentioned this EPA, two EPA proposals to regulate coal ash. What's the status of that, first of all?
Well, right now, there's actually no status. They've been proposed. They've gone through the comment process, and the EPA will presumably make a decision about that, I would expect, sometime this year. But there are two proposals, like I said in the story, which is kind of unusual. Usually the EPA throws out a rule and people comment on it and they revise it and it's finalized. This time they threw out two rules. And one would, of course, make coal ash a hazardous waste, and the other would make it a special waste.
And I understand there is legislation being proposed that would undercut this proposal?
Yeah, it's a bill sponsored by David McKinley, who's a freshman congressman from West Virginia. And it was actually co-sponsored. It's got a number of co-sponsors, including all four of Kentucky's Republican representatives, Ed Whitfield, Brett Guthrie, Jeff Davis, and Hal Rogers. And this bill would basically would stop the EPA from trying to reclassify coal ash as a hazardous waste. And it most recently passed through the Energy and Commerce Committee earlier this month. So that bill is still alive and, you know, and moving.
Well, obviously, you put a lot of work into these pieces and you gathered a lot of material. Anything that you had to leave out that you kind of hoped was in there, would be in there?
Yeah, there were pages and pages of things that I wanted to put in there and just couldn't because of time. One of the things I found really interesting that I didn't have a chance to go into was the issue of water quality around these sites. And they're actually, they don't look very complex. The landfill and the pond don't look very complex on the outside, but they are designed so runoff from the landfill drains into the pond, is how the company explains it. And then the pond, the metals settle in the pond and it's, you know, filtered out and discharges into the river. But there are a lot of concerns about the fact that there are no liners on these sites. There's no, in this particular plant, there's no liner between the coal ash and the ground. And there have been studies done on other similar sites that show that the metals are actually leaching into the soil and contaminating the groundwater.
What do you hope for people to take away from this piece?
Well, I wanted people to know, I want people to know what's happening, that that coal ash is a problem. And coal ash is something that we're going to have as long as we burn coal. It's not something that LG&E is doing wrong by creating this coal ash. It's kind of inevitable. Well, one of the things I find kind of ironic is that more coal ash is created when you put pollution controls on these plants, because stuff that used to just go up the smokestack is now being captured and then stored in these landfills. So we're cleaning the air quality, but creating more waste in the process. And this is something that that is just a part of burning coal that people around power plants and around other disposal sites have to live with. And if we want to get a handle on the problem, people I've talked to seem to agree that we need to recycle it more in safe ways, and we need to, you know, start cutting down our burning of coal.
Just a few seconds left. Have you gotten any reaction from anyone on this point?
Some people have left some thoughtful comments on our Facebook site. Pretty much saying that, you know, either they weren't aware this was a problem or, you know, talking about what they think can be done about it. And, yeah, you can read the stories, too, if you go to our webpage, WFPL.org, or onto our Facebook page.
WFPL Environment Reporter Erica Peterson, great job, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rick.
When we come back, we'll talk about the latest in the debt ceiling talks in Washington with James Carroll of the Courier-Journal. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett, and we're going to be turning our attention now to goings-on in the nation's capital, particularly the debt ceiling talks. So we invite your comments at 814-8255, 814-8255, or 1-877-814-8255. That's 1-877-814-8255, or talk. And joining us now is Jim Carroll with the Courier-Journal, and it's a bureau in Washington, D.C. Hi, Jim.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm great. I'm not outside.
I was going to say Washington this time of year is is not very pleasant to start with, but you're under this big dome of heat that we're getting here as well.
Yes, I just checked. It said it was 100 degrees and it feels like 116, so it's stinking hot.
Yikes. Yikes.
Yeah, and you could describe that for the politics too. So
I was going to that's a nice transition to the debt ceiling talks. So, well, what's the latest today?
You tell me. You know, whatever I say at this hour of the day, it will probably be wrong or superseded or otherwise changed by the next hour. That's sort of the way things have been going. You know, we're, as everybody probably knows by now, the United States is facing an August 2 deadline for raising the debt ceiling, or the U.S. would go into default. It's kind of a complicated situation, starting with the fact that there's political disagreement here in Washington. I know this is shocking that people don't agree even on what the meaning of going into default is. But a lot of economists out there and people on Wall Street and people in the business community don't want to find out just how bad going into default would affect the economy, which is already in a kind of a tenuous state. So assuming that, Boehner, House Speaker Boehner, President Obama, and Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, and others, you know, say they are determined to avoid going into default. How do you get there? That's the question. And I think in some ways it sort of boils down to tax or no tax. That's, that is the question. To be taxed or not to be taxed. Essentially, you have a lot of schools of thought on what should happen, but one of the most fundamental disagreements is whether any increased revenue should be part of a deficit cutting deal, which would be tied into this debt ceiling increase, or there is probably the more liberal members of the Senate are in that school where they believe there should be some revenues, and it's a deal killer if there aren't any. And then on the far right conservative end and in the Tea Party caucus, anything that looks, smells, feels, tastes like a tax increase is a deal killer. Mm. Now, how do you come to something in the middle? That is the Rubik's Cube question of the moment. And there are various long-term and short-term deals that are bouncing around town. And as you no doubt know, and your listeners no doubt know, we've been hearing false reports of a near deal for a couple of days. People immediately run to the microphones and insist there's no deal. Then we hear there's another deal in the works. There are various parties and a lot of moving parts. One of my favorite new phrases that has gained currency here in Washington in the last couple of days is there are many trains headed for the station. Now, as we all know, many trains headed for the station. You certainly hope they're on separate tracks, or you're going to have one heck of a collision at the end of this. You do have people working on a variety of different plans, and it's very hard to tell. From hour to hour, which plan is gaining currency and which one is fading.
Now, Senator McConnell has floated, you call it a stopgap plan that would let the president raise the debt ceiling
right. Temporarily.
How's that playing out?
Well, again, even that one, you basically what he wanted to do was give the president the authority to come to Congress three times between now and the end of his term to raise the debt ceiling. This would be, as you said, and as Senator McConnell has said, it would be a stopgap approach. But it's also considered sort of a short-term approach that doesn't really get to the larger issues that some members of Congress want to get to, which is getting the spending under control and, long-term and reducing the debt and the deficit. But when he first proposed this last week, McConnell got considerable support from some members of his party, but a lot of Democrats said it was very much worth considering. And it's still out there, sort of floating around as a backup. But Obama and Boehner and others have continued to say that they'd like to cut a bigger deal. Some people call it the grand bargain, where you would do some significant cuts now. In exchange for raising the debt ceiling and do some other things as well, including make some changes to the entitlement programs, the big programs, Social Security and Medicare, farther down the track. But it's very hard to tell whether, it's all a matter of votes. And I know a great shock again, politics here in D.C. And you've got to have the votes for whatever comes out of these negotiations. And that is the difficult math right now that they're having trouble with.
And before we run out of time on a different topic, anybody that you know of from the delegation coming down for Fancy Farm in 2 weeks?
I have to confess that I have been looking elsewhere, so I am not 100% up to date on Fancy Farm, which is always, of course, a place where you talk about political heat and rhetoric. It's a practice of a fine, high art there at Fancy Farm, that's for sure. But I can't say for sure. I don't know who is coming and who isn't at this point. And it may be determined a little bit, too, by where Congress is at that point.
All right. Jim Carroll from the Courier-Journal, as always, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's all the time we have for today's program. State of the News is produced by the WFPL News staff. And our production team is led by Brad Yost and Laura Ellis. You can write to us at news@wfpl.org. I'm Rick Howlett. Thanks for joining us. Have a good weekend.